Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. China responded to worldwide news detailing its island reclamation efforts in the South China Sea this week. The Chinese Foreign Ministry stated that the dredging and construction of new islands is intended to provide shelter from typhoons, provide for missile defense, and navigation aids. China's claims to the features are disputed by ASEAN states Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, and Brunei, as well as Taiwan. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter visited Japan and South Korea this week in his first trip to the region since taking office. In Tokyo, he discussed updating bilateral defense guidelines with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and in Seoul, he announced that the United States has no plans yet to deploy a missile defense system to the region. Carter also became the first U.S. Secretary of Defense to visit the memorial for the Chonan, honoring 46 South Korean sailors who were killed by North Korean torpedoes in 2010. In regional economic news, the Bank of Korea cut the 2015 growth forecast for the Korean economy. The bank froze the key interest rate at its monthly policy meeting and reduced the forecast from 3.4% growth down to 3.1%, the second such revision in 3 months. Bank officials cited the weaker-than-expected recovery pace of Asia's fourth-largest economy. India's government evacuated over 5,000 civilians in response to coalition fighting in Yemen this week. The effort required 18 special evacuation flights and multiple naval operations. India also helped 960 foreigners from 41 countries evacuate Yemen, including some from the United States. Meanwhile, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi personally thanked Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif for the rescue of 11 Indian citizens by a Pakistani warship, which removed them from Al-Qaeda-controlled Al-Mokhala. And that's the news. Now we return to Secretary of Defense Ash Carter's trip to Japan and South Korea. I sat down with CSIS Japan Chair Fellow Zach Cooper to discuss Carter's visit, the US-Japan alliance, and security developments in the region. Defense Secretary Ash Carter, he's heading to Korea and Japan, two countries that we have a pretty strong relationship with. Why do you think he's choosing to go there so early in his tenure?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that many secretaries of defense want to show their commitment to Asia-Pacific because the Asia-Pacific region is just so important to the United States. And there's always a debate about where to go first. Do you go to China first because China is such an important growing player, or do you go see your allies and partners first? And most secretaries of defense have chosen to see allies and partners first, and so I think stopping in Northeast Asia, going to Japan and Korea, is a smart move for the secretary so that he can get to see his counterparts in the region before he comes back to Washington and tries to figure out how to handle Asia policy writ large.
And there's obviously a lot happening in Japan right now with their focus on defense kind of shifting from a more defense posture to, some could say, a little more active. How influential is the U.S. in that, and what stakes do they have to play there?
Well, Prime Minister Abe has an important agenda, and I think it's critical for the United States that Prime Minister Abe succeeds in his agenda. So he's been attempting to make Japan a more proactive player in the region. And part of that mission includes an ability for the Japanese self-defense forces to work more closely with the United States, to help defend U.S. forces if they're attacked in a crisis, but also to coordinate more closely at all rungs of the escalation ladder. There is a bilateral coordination mechanism which has never been used in the alliance. And so one part of the effort to revise the bilateral defense guidelines is to update this mechanism so that it would be more usable in a crisis. And one issue that the Japanese are particularly concerned about is Chinese incursions into what the Japanese believe are their territorial waters around the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. Now, the one challenge for the United States is how it should be involved in these areas. And the effort by the United States and Japan to revise the bilateral defense guidelines will help to allow the United States to be more closely engaged in that area and potentially to work with the Japanese to deter Chinese efforts to change the status quo.
And how much of an impact do you think it's really going to have? I mean, the U.S. feeling threatened and having Japanese have to move in on their behalf, it seems a bit outlandish considering what the U.S. has to bring to bear. Is this just more of a could you see this as more of a cultural shift on the Japanese part rather than something that might actually have a big practical impact immediately?
Well, I think there are two major aspects. As you're saying, there's a major cultural shift that has to happen in Japan. Japan has been talking about proactive pacifism. And one of the reasons is that the Chinese are clearly changing facts on the ground. And it's causing, I think, a change in Japanese culture. The society realizes that it needs to respond more directly to these Chinese efforts to alter the status quo, not just in the East China Sea, but potentially in the South China Sea as well. So that's one aspect. I'd say the other aspect, and one area where I do think the United States has an important role to play, is trying to deter what the Japanese call gray zone coercion, this lower level coercion. And there, although the United States has an incredibly strong military, we haven't been able to stop the Chinese from doing what they've done. And so part of revising the guidelines and working together on the alliance is actually finding a way that the U.S. and Japan can deter changes to the status quo. I think that's something that we'll hear talked about a great deal when Prime Minister Abe visits Washington later in April.
And I want to pick up on one of your points there about the Chinese in the South China Sea. Obviously, it's big news this week. It's front page of the New York Times about, and we've talked about this on the Cogitasia podcast before, but this idea of land reclamation in the South China Sea in disputed areas. Secretary Carter talked about it this week. And also the head of Pacific Fleet Command was talking about this idea of a great wall of sand being built by China in these areas. How is the U.S. equipped to kind of deal with that and I guess, create more of a dialogue there? And how are the rest of the partners in the region affected by that?
Well, I think the U.S. policy is still changing in this area. So for a long time, the United States has insisted that it will not take it will not become a member of the disputes between China and various regional states. However, it has recently been forced to come out and say that it will support Japan if there are any efforts made to change the status quo situation, which is Japan's administrative control of the Senkakus. I think there are probably some in Washington who are trying to debate whether they should do something similar in the South China Sea. There are others who are concerned that China might announce a South China Sea Air Defense Identification Zone, an ADIZ, similar to that that the Chinese announced in the East China Sea in 2013. So those are some of the big questions, but I don't think those national security experts in Washington necessarily have answers to those questions yet. I think this policy is still developing.
Okay, and I want to talk about another thing that Carter talked about this week, which was interesting for a defense secretary to speak about, but it was the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TPP, saying the ratification of it is as important as an aircraft carrier. Why is that the case from a defense perspective?
This is a fascinating issue in my mind. So Secretary Carter is echoing something that I think probably most famously Secretary Gates said several years ago, which is that cooperation on diplomatic issues and on economic issues is as important for security as having more forces. And I think part of the reason is that the United States is trying to build a strong system which is able to allow China to grow into it, but that system has to be resilient. And part of that resilience means a strong economy and strong economic links across the Pacific. And so Secretary Carter has talked about the importance of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. I think that's incredibly important. I'll just note that I think one challenge for Secretary Carter is that in the last several weeks, the administration has been putting forward the importance of TPP and framing it as an issue of allowing the U.S. to dictate the rules, the economic rules in Asia, and make a high standards trade deal rather than allowing the Chinese to dictate those rules. And I think one danger for Secretary Carter is that the rebalance, which has been so security focused to date, could appear to be almost containment of China. I don't think that's true in any way, but that's certainly the line that one hears in China, that this is part of the China threat theory. And so I think Secretary Carter needs to combat that kind of perception. And one danger is that if the United States links TPP too closely to a U.S.-based rules and order system and makes it too and makes it appear that that system is not allowing China to rise into it, that can be a real problem. And we've seen this recently on a different economic issue, which is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, for which the United States apparently tried to convince some allies and partners not to join, and then some of those allies joined anyways. So I think this is an area that Secretary Carter is likely to continue emphasizing, but it's a tricky argument to make given what's happened in recent weeks.
Well, it's something we'll have to keep looking at. Zach Cooper, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Zach Cooper. Next up is our weekly leaderboard profile. This week, we highlight Zhu Wenzhong. Zhu Wenzhong has served as the Secretary General of the BOAO Forum for Asia since 2010. He is also Vice President of the China-US People's Friendship Association. A career diplomat, Ambassador Zhu has held a number of high positions in Beijing and abroad, including as Chinese Ambassador to the United States from 2005 to 2010. Zhu played a major role in planning the annual BOAO Forum, held the last week of March in the southern Chinese province of Hainan. This year's event featured 77 separate panel discussions and presentations from a host of foreign leaders over 3 days and was organized around the theme of moving Asia towards a community of common destiny. Under Zhu's stewardship over the past 5 years, the forum's prominence has grown significantly, evident in both the expanding attendance and growing international attention focused on the event. President Xi Jinping made the decision to give a major speech on China's much-touted One Belt, One Road strategy at the forum, which coincided with the release of a new vision statement on the initiative from China's top economic planning agency. Zhu is known for being well-connected and a consummate diplomat during his time as ambassador to the United States. In his role as Secretary General, Zhu has been outspoken on the importance of building Asia-centric organizations. He has argued that this is critical to strengthening the region's integration and self-reliance and enhancing Asian nations' role in global economic governance, one of the central stated goals of the BOAO Forum. More recently, Zhu's remarks have focused on the challenges and opportunities of implementing China's One Belt, One Road initiative, a major focus at BOAO this year. Moving forward, Ambassador Zhu will likely continue to play an important role in supporting Beijing's efforts to promote and enlist support for the initiatives it involves. And now on to our one to watch. Koala bears are leaving Oz on an important diplomatic mission. To celebrate the 50th anniversary of Australia-Singapore relations, the Australian government announced on April 9th that they are sending the gift of 4 koalas to the Singapore Zoo. Currently, the bears are under quarantine in Brisbane before they travel to Singapore. The Australian government has provided custom-built, climate-controlled capsules, equipped with a tree and nutritious eucalyptus leaves to keep them comfortable on their journey. Australian airline Qantas will transport fresh leaves for the duration of their 3-year stay, which is necessary because Singapore has no eucalyptus tree population, and each koala can eat more than a pound of leaves each day. This initiative was reportedly the brainchild of Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop and her Singaporean counterpart, Minister of Foreign Affairs Shanmugam. The gift proves soft power can take many forms. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.